Today on Maine Calling, how a clash of cultures has divided America. We're called the United States, a federation of geographical divisions of various sizes, each with its own history and identity. But journalist and historian Colin Woodard has a different vision of the map, as a collection of distinct nations, with cultural histories that still shape the contentious policy debates of today and have brought American democracy to the brink. From Yankeedom to New Netherland to Tidewater and El Norte, Woodard believes each of these regions has its own strong views on the meaning of liberty and how best to achieve it. These differences, he argues, can explain why we're so divided on major issues, from guns to abortion to the role of government in our lives. Today on the program, we'll talk with Colin Woodard about his new book, Nations Apart. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. It may not be news that we are a divided nation. The challenge is to determine how this happened and what, if anything, can be done to bridge these rifts. That's the subject of Colin Woodard's new book, Nations Apart: How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. He joins us today. What's your take on how we got here and on the state of our democracy? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. Colin Woodard, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here again.
So this book expands on this ongoing research on regional differences in ideology. In fact, I discussed your very first book, American Nations, on this same program. In fact, the very first edition of Maine Calling, the first
the day premiere.
Of the program, back premiere back in 2011, I guess it is, so 14 years ago. For the uninitiated, you make this case that to understand the divisions within the United States, you need to look not at just red states and blue states and purple states, but at these distinct nations, these smaller nations within the boundaries, each with a different vision of democratic government and different takes on freedom.
Absolutely. And the differences between these regions are enormous, and they date back to the beginning of colonial settlement. I mean, we had these rival colonial projects that took form on the eastern and southwestern rims of what's the United States. You know, the Puritans in New England, the Dutch around New York City, the Scots-Irish into the backcountry, West Indies slave lords into the southern lowlands, you know, Tidewater, you know, the gentry families, the second and third sons from the English manor families moving into the Chesapeake, Spanish moving south to north and into the southwest, and so on. And these different, colonial projects were set up at different times by people with distinct ethnographic, political, and religious characteristics who did not think that they were all going to wind up in a continent-spanning federation together. And lo and behold, after the revolution, they did. But the distinctions between their political projects and their cultures have remained, and even more profound because they settled much of the continent in mutually exclusive settlement bands, where, you know, the New Englanders started settling a certain band of the Northeast, and below them, you know, the next regional culture, and so on and so forth. And once you know that map, which doesn't correspond to state or even international boundaries, you have just mapped the tectonic plates that you will see over and over again, not only in our politics, but in, you know, spatial mapping of health outcomes, of FICO credit scores, of, you know, results in genetics, in, you know, all manner of things, life expectancy, gun violence, who has insurance and who doesn't. It's the the ultimate decoder for understanding regional divides in this country, and indeed why we have red states, blue states, and purple states, which are usually riven by multiple regional cultures.
So listeners might be thinking at this moment who aren't familiar with your work or who might be, well, you know, wait a minute, what about the passage of, you know, 200 or 300 years here? What about migration? What about the saturation of media? How could these ideologies within these founding groups of these regions this long ago still be a compelling force in all of these debates that we're still having today?
Yeah, how is it that mass retailing, mass communications, mass migration, mass immigration, all of these things have happened, and surely the whatever residual effect you had from 3 or 4 centuries ago would have disappeared. But no, when you look at the data, if anything, it's been the differences between these regional cultures and whatever you look at have been increasing, not decreasing over time. And there, you know, there are different reasons for that, depending on what factor we're looking at. But briefly, in terms of people who migrate, social scientists have looked at this, and essentially, as they track people who've migrated through their driver's licenses and then, you know, poll them on things, as a group, the people who move from one place to another more resemble their destination than their point of origin. In other words, people frustrated where they live are moving to be among like-minded people. And in the process, they are ending up sorting to a great degree across these regional cultures. But in immigration, for instance, the great 1880 to 1924 immigration wave that so profoundly changed American ideas about identity and belonging, forcing legacy Protestant America to finally kicking and screaming accept that Catholics, Orthodox Christians, and Jews at least could be full-fledged Americans too. That whole immigration wave was completely maldistributed on the map. We actually took census data and looked, because census takers in 1900 said, hey, you foreign-born or not, to every single person. So we have the data. And the answer is essentially nobody went to the regions I call the Deep South, Tidewater, and Greater Appalachia. Think the Confederate states and then a big extension of the Upland South extending into the lower Great Lakes states, Kentucky, West Virginia, parts of Missouri. That whole swath had almost no immigrants in the midst of this 19th century and early 20th century immigration wave, like 1 to 3% foreign-born, while all the other regions are, you know, 18, 20, 25, 35% foreign-born. So the ideas about who's an American, what's normal, what religion is normal, that immigration wave increased the differences between the regions, not decreased it. And so there's many counterintuitive things that have happened like that that have either been countervailing forces to the homogenization of the regions or indeed have actually made the differences wider.
Yeah, I want to talk – we'll talk more about immigration a little bit later and more specifically about some of these individual nations and their origins and their beliefs. But there's something you mentioned in the book in the discussion – this discussion of the persistence of these ideological tendencies in these regions, and it's called the doctrine of first effective settlement. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, that's the sort of academic foundations of American Nations, the previous book that we spoke about back when the show started 14 years ago, and of this book. And that is the cultural geographer Wilbur Zielinski back in the 1970s was asking a question cultural geographers often do. You know, we know how cultures transmit over time in our field. Anthropologists have talked about that, how individuals, you know, learn it from their families and their schools and the institutions around them and the stories that are celebrated in their churches. You transmit cultural values over time, individual to individual, which allows them to persist for centuries or millennia. But how does a new culture get started? Zielinski wondered. You know, people arrive in a place where there were no people, or expunge, or, you know, destroyed the civilization around them and took over. How does that culture get started? And his theory, which I think has been proven correct, is that the first group of settlers that managed to create a self-perpetuating society that extends out over time, the characteristics of that group of people will have an amazingly undue influence over the future trajectory, characteristics, and development of that culture, even if their numbers were very small and the numbers of people who came later were very large, because they set down the assumptions and institutions. They format the hard drive, if you will, for the culture of that region. And when the rest of us show up, even if we're outnumber them a gazillion to one, that's the cultural norm that we're dealing with, grappling with, you know, may largely assimilate into over time, that they've kind of set it all in motion. And that's the argument in American Nations. Basically traced each of these rival regional cultures and where each of those settlement streams went to be the first effective settlers. And that's the map. Everything subsequent, you know, data, elections and such, you know, let the chips fall where they may. But amazingly, the chips often fall right along those lines from often centuries ago.
And in terms of our national identity, that unifying force that makes the French French or the Italians Italians, although they have their own regions. But unlike these European countries you point out, you know, the United States doesn't have a very long history to have this kind of combined, unified identity as American. And that's part of what's playing out here.
Yeah, it's our difficulty is that each of these regional cultures, you know, they were a couple centuries old, some of them by the time of the Revolution. And the Revolution was really a battle of the separate colonies. All of them were threatened individually by a change in British imperial policy in the 1770s that was going to force each of them to give up their own idiosyncratic ways of doing things. It was a threat to the way of life and politics and power in each colony. So they ganged together to face off this common threat, a sort of ragtag rebel alliance. And lo and behold, they won. But when they won, they found themselves in something called the United States of America together. And they weren't sure what that was. You know, nobody was sure in the 1770s or in the 1780s when we wrote the Constitution, or even in 1800, 1820. And they needed to know because, you know, is this a nation state? Is this a sort of a NATO-like alliance? Is this supposed to be an EU? And the problem was that people then, all the way into the early 19th century, if you ask them what country they were from, they would have said, I'm a Connecticuter, I'm a, you know, Massachusettsian, I'm a South Carolinian. The idea of what it meant to be a United Statesian was still very vague and fought over. So there was a battle pretty quickly over trying to define in the early 19th century, a whole generation after the Revolution, what this country was for, who belonged, and all of the rest. And so, yeah, we are a federation, in a sense, of stateless nations, of these rival regional cultures who have not been in agreement over what the United States at large should be ever. And that's been sort of our eternal struggle that plays out through today.
And you mentioned some of these nations, but let's just refamiliarize ourselves with them and go down through the list, starting with those that began here in the East at the very beginnings of the nation. So, for example, let's start with Yankeedom. What are the boundaries, its origins quickly, and its beliefs?
Sure, I'll try to do them super fast, but Yankeedom is the greater New England cultural space. It started with the early Puritans arriving in 1630s in Massachusetts Bay. Here's a group of people who thought they were in an old, you know, Testament covenanted relationship with God, like the biblical Hebrews, who'd sent them to do certain things in the wilderness to create a perfect Calvinist society. They would be punished or rewarded as a group. And so an individual could mess things up for everybody. So it was always a project through their institutions with a mission to create a better world as they understood it in the New England frontier. But just to their south was this Dutch settled area around what's now greater New York City is what kind of bit was the remnant. And that was the Dutch in the 1600s. Amsterdam was like the most sophisticated, you know, trading state in the entire Western world. And they created a sort of little micro village clone of Golden Age Amsterdam, a global commercial city-state trading with various empires, not a lot of emphasis on democracy or morals, but a huge emphasis on freedom of conscience and inquiry and in, you know, making things happen to, you know, have commerce succeed. And if you go further south, you had the William Penn's Quaker experiment, which resulted in the Midlands. The Quakers believed in, and people had an inner light. So they were like, oh, anybody can come here. People are basically good. And that resulted in a regional culture that is culturally pluralistic. You can come here, immigrants, and keep your culture. you know, have an entire community with that culture, and that's fine because nobody's in charge. A mosaic, you know, you can have a, you know, a village where everyone is from some German Pietist sect and your schools are in that German and some strange dialect in your churches, and that's fine. And next door will be the Mennonites, and next door to that will be the Amish, and then there'll be a Danish community. So like a, you know, a cultural mosaic. That culture extends from Delaware Bay around Philly and that area out through a middle section of the country, through the middle sections of the lower Great Lakes states, and then fans out into the heartland across Iowa and into the plains, whereas the Yankee space is greater, you know, the New England states and then the upstate of New York, which New Englanders colonized after the Dutch defeat in the 1670s, the Western Reserve of Connecticut, the northern part of Ohio along Lake Erie where Cleveland is, and then the upper Great Lakes states largely were all in New England space. And then you keep going south from there and you have the Chesapeake country, the Tidewater, which was founded around the same time as New England by English people, but a completely different group, the second, third, fourth, fifth sons of the great English manor families. You know, Lord Grantham's younger children who were not going to inherit, you know, Downton Abbey at home. So, you know, tough luck. The firstborn gets that. Except the discovery of the New World meant that many of them could dream of coming to the New World and creating brand new manor estates, which is what they tried to do. But they couldn't find anyone to stand in for the serfs, so they tried indentured servants. And then by, as you move towards the end of the 1600s, they saw what the deep southerners were doing down in their area and became a slave system. But you get, so you have this schizophrenic society of enlightened, you know, English gentlemen and presiding over slaveholding. So you can have, you know, oh, the natural rights of man, Jefferson will write about, and Madison and Washington, well, they tend these slave plantations because of that weird origin. You go further south.
Yeah. Greater Appalachia, I wanted to also.
Yeah, Greater Appalachia is in the back country, came a little bit later. So but one of the results of the William Penn and the Quakers letting anyone in is the biggest group of people who came in were these people from the war-torn borderlands of Britain, especially Ulster, but also the lowlands of Scotland and the English marches, places where government was non-existent or trying to wipe you out with lances and bowmen. Institutions were weak. You had to protect your kith and kin yourself. It created sort of a warrior culture of people prizing individual liberty and personal autonomy. They were also prized for, as border people that you could take to protect your colony by putting them out on the frontier to fight the indigenous people whose land you were taking. Queen Elizabeth did that first in Ulster, bringing lowland Scots to Northern Ireland to keep down the Irish. But then in the colonies, they were encouraged to go out along the frontier, the Appalachian frontier, and formed what is now the biggest and most populous of all the regional cultures, a massive area stretching from southwestern Pennsylvania, where it started, one branch through the uplands of the southern states like Virginia and North Carolina and northern Alabama, you know, most of Tennessee, down into the, you know, the Ozarks and onto the Texas Hill Country, another branch rafting down the Ohio River from Kentucky to the lower parts of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, and so on, and into parts of the Midwest. And then there's the Deep South, which was West Indies planters who created a perfect slave society, horrifying slave society of, you know, for sugar plantation on Barbados, and they'd run out of land on Barbados by the 1670s and just transplanted a West Indies slave system to the new Carolinas colony, which spread over the lowland south. Yeah. And you got Spanish-settled borderlands and so
yeah.
on.
We'll spread out west here, and we're going to take a short break, and we'll come back, and we'll sort of describe what happened out west. And of course, then continue with how these regions still inform and still guide the debates that we're having today on some major issues. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to hear from you. The number, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Our subject today, a divided nation and what might help bring the country together. With me is Colin Woodard. He's a journalist, author, and director of the Nationhood Lab at Salve Regina University's Pell Center for International Relations and Public Policy. His new book is Nations Apart, How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. We invite you to join the conversation. Email us at talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We got through some of the nations, and I guess got a good taste there, and maybe we can bring up the the Western nations as we go along. But I want to get a sense of how different these regions are, which would lead us into understanding the different positions on these issues. If you were to pick two nations that were so far apart on a particular, could you give an example, for example, of a nation that is very far apart on another area of the country on a particular issue and why?
Yeah, on multiple issues, you know, Yankeedom and the greater Appalachian space of the, you know, those Scots-Irish and Scots-Lowlanders are usually on opposite sides of the spectrum, because the, you know, the heritage going back in Yankeedom to the Puritans is that we're a group of people on a mission together, and what's important is the mission, not necessarily the individual. And so it's about ultimately the common good. There's a faith in institutions, because the Puritans set up little micro republics, little town governments, you know, where you have, even in Maine today, the town meetings, where each town is theoretically sovereign over a vast array of things that in other regions would be handled at the county level. And, you know, you have control over your church congregation and all of the rest. So the belief is that government is us, is an extension of the people, that we operate through it, and a general faith in institutions, and that you can make the world better through government is, there's a much stronger sense of that in Yankeedom than a lot of other regions. It's about the common good over the individual if the two come in conflict. That's totally the opposite of the greater Appalachian experience. Being from those war-torn areas, there is no faith in institutions. There was no institutions you could trust in the historical memory of the early settlement group. And that resulted in a place where government is entirely seen as an enemy. It can only be a force for tyranny. Institutions are weak. And the emphasis is on individual freedom, personal autonomy, that you have to make sure that the individual is has no oppression from government or anybody else, preferably. So how does that translate to issues? You know, if you have one that's highly individualistic and distrustful of shared institutions, and one that's the other way around, take, you know, gun control. Right. There's a classic issue where if you poll the two regions, people in one region will say, you know, by a huge margin that it's more important to protect the safety of the community than the gun holding rights of the individual. In the other region, it will be totally different. And when you go to gun violence rates, you know, how do you solve things in greater Appalachia? You're supposed to protect your kith and kin yourself. All indices of violence on a per capita level are much, much higher than in the Yankeedom region, even though Yankeedom includes, you know, parts of Chicago and the upper Midwest, Minneapolis and Boston, all kinds of cities and stuff in that region. But you have like almost a threefold difference in per capita gun deaths. You go to the COVID pandemic and you see a map of vaccinations. You know, you have almost a 2-to-1 difference in vaccination rates per capita between those two regions. Again, a common good individual liberty perspective. You also have enormous difference in the number of deaths from COVID, and so on and so forth. Because so many things, you know, attitudes about whether to confront climate change and take steps to confront a common good problem through sacrifices by the individual, those things pull the same way. So you get these enormous differences on that central question in American life. How do you further the, you know, the effort to create a free society? Do you maximize the freedom of the individual, or do you try to reinvest and provide for the infrastructure that makes it possible for individuals to be free? You know, is it a common project cultivating a Republican citizenry? Those are two totally different approaches, and that puts those two regions at odds with each other on almost everything.
So how do you parse out how much influence these old, long-lasting ideologies from history are affecting views as opposed to education levels or poverty or religion? You know, how do you decide, oh, it's 50% that and 60%, well, it's too much percent there, but how do you decide what the share is?
Well, we do it with data. So we've have all of the counties coded in the United States, and we can run data and tell you exactly what the stats are for each of these regions as a whole. But also knowing the characteristics of the counties, you can then say, okay, well, maybe it's just because there's more urban places here and more rural ones there. You can just compare rural counties to one another across the regions. You can just compare rich counties or poor counties or, you know, counties with good health care and not, counties with unusually high education levels or unusually low education levels. You can compare just the experience for the variable you're looking at for just white people or just African Americans or just Latino people or just women or just men. So through those things, you can start seeing and comparing the data and actually know the answer. And in almost all cases, you know, the gaps I'm describing, that order of magnitude of gap of many-fold differences per capita persist, even if you compare across those things to control for the other factors. One, you know, crazy thing, we did life expectancy, 3 to 5 year population level differences between some of these large regions that also didn't go away. And we did one experiment. We took the top quartile of all counties in the United States, the richest ones, the ones with the highest income levels. And we looked at the ones that are, you know, just in Yankeedom and just in the Deep South. And we also looked at the lowest quartile counties in the entire United States that happened to be in those two things and compared their life expectancies. The shocking thing was of the richest counties in the United States that are in the Deep South, their average life expectancy was slightly lower than the poorest quartile of counties in the entire country that happened to be in Yankeedom. In other words, you know, the richest places have lower life expectancy than the poorest counties. And you see a lot of stuff like that in the data.
You were no doubt surprised by these findings.
Well, I was not surprised that there would be differences. I was sometimes surprised both by the level of county level affinity to the old settlement patterns. You know, not just the numbers overall across these regions, but you could see the regional lines in much of this data. You know, per capita obesity, diabetes, FICO credit scores. I mean, things that shouldn't necessarily. It's a little counterintuitive that you would see that level of affinity. We do. So that's always surprising. And the level of the gaps, the starkness of them, is sometimes pretty remarkable.
It's interesting, in the most recent election we just had, there are maps by town of how each vote went. And and the patterns were exactly the same for one. The passage of one and the failure of the other were
in the main
colors,
referenda,
yes.
I found that amazing. Yeah, that almost exactly the same results, exactly the same municipal results in Maine for two ballot initiatives that are quite different, right? Yeah. You would think you'd see some variation on a gun measure and a voting measure, but no. Yeah, I found that pretty amazing myself, especially when there was nothing higher on the ballot to draw in people to turn out. It wasn't like they were voting for governor and did this as a sideline. You're just getting sort of a partisan vote. They were two very different flavors. So I find that remarkable, too.
Let's go to Chris in Auburn. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. This is a fascinating topic. I'm actually a transplant myself. I came from England. My dad was Air Force. And I moved to this country when I was about 18, 19. And I had culture shock at how right-wing this country was back then. that's when I got my first introduction to Rush Limbaugh. And I used to listen to him in the car all the time on AM. And he would go on and on about how Democrats hate America, hate freedom, hate the country, hate the military. And I always scratch my head and say, well, my dad's a Democrat. He's got 3 flying crosses and did 200 missions in Vietnam. I challenge you to go tell my dad he hates America. And then that Fox News came into existence, and it reflected that same stuff about, you know, how Democrats hate America, hate freedom, hate the country. And then that crept eventually into general right-wing politics, into the Republican Party. Most recently, Speaker Johnson, and I'm going to quote him, he said about Democrats, they hate capitalism, they hate our free enterprise system, they hate our principles, they hate our ideas, they hate the idea of individual freedom and limited government, they hate the idea of rule of law, and they fight against it all the time. And that's what we're up against, right? Because 45% of this country listens to Fox News, OAN, Rush, the old Rush Limbaugh stuff, Sean Hannity, Jeannie Pirro, Glenn Beck. And I watch these things and I listen to them all the time. And that's all they say. They talk constantly fake lies that you then hear on C-SPAN in the morning with the Republican callers. So the question is, how do you fix this? You cannot, when we have a free press and the lies are being spouted so constantly.
Yeah, Colin, you do address this sort of where do we go from here part. How would you respond to Chris?
Yeah, I mean, definitely those have all been accelerants that have greatly increased the tribal nature of our existence. And there's no equivalent on the left, if you will. There was a very concerted and strategic effort on the right and far right to build this kind of media enterprise, and it's paid off. It's converted a lot of people. It speaks to the importance of story. Humans are storytelling species. We organize information that way. We transmit information to each other by stories. And story is really, really important. And the big Uber story, on the far right has now taken hold of a lot of Americans, which questions even whether we should be a democratic society, who belongs. Vice President J.D. Vance had a very prominent speech at the Claremont Institute this summer where he essentially argued against the ideals-based promise in the Declaration, identification of what it means to be an American in favor of a sort of blood and soil version where, you needed to be a descendant of somebody who fought in the Civil War kind of thing. And so, that's a very different approach than you would have seen 25, 30 years ago. What do you do about that? Well, we know from our polling at the project I run at Salve Regina University's Pell Center, we call it Nationhood Lab. A lot of the work in Nations Apart went into that. And we did a whole bunch of polling and interviews and such to develop a way of talking about the good side of our definition of the United States, that we're a people who may not share a history or a religion or an ethnicity, but what we share is dedication to a set of ideals, the ones in the Declaration of Independence, the notion that all humans have this right given to them by God or the universe to survive, to not be tyrannized, to pursue their happiness as they understand it, and to access the representative self-government that makes it all possible. That's the civic nationhood that Frederick Douglass, fought for in every speech he made. It's Lincoln at Gettysburg and Martin Luther King Jr. on the Mall. It's the American promise. But we've forgotten how to talk about that story, which lets the gnat, like Fox News thing and all those corrosive effects run wild. If you leave something uncountered for a long time, it's going to get worse. So how do you talk about that stuff? Well, we've developed a sort of core narrative frame, as communications people describe it, of how you talk about what the United States really should be and, who belongs and the meaning of our history. And, the polling on this compared to that ethno-national definition of the country, people across all sorts of segments support the Declaration's ideals over that, like 60-40, regardless of region and gender and education level and so on. It's very popular. And if you just ask people straight out, hey, do you think that Americans are duty-bound as Americans to protect one another's natural rights to all these things in the Declaration? I thought maybe it'll be 60-40. Let's hope. It was a later poll. 97-2 in favor. I mean, almost universal support for that idea if you just put it out there. So, this is an idea that's not only a good idea and a good set of ideals and an antidote to the hate-oriented version of things, but it's also latently incredibly popular. And we as a people need to start making use of that. You need to have a meta story that's a good and constructive one on the other side, or, the festering meta story created to drive us apart will succeed if uncountered.
You mentioned the speech by J.D. Vance recently, who is a self-identified Appalachian, and declaring that, America's essentially America's not an idea. It's, it's people. But how does that
particular people, right? Particular, not everybody.
Yeah. So how does that jibe then with the role he's playing in this extremely controlling, much more controlling government? And this is a guy who at one point was not a Trump fan. So is that just politics interfering?
J.D. Vance personally is incredibly flexible in his ideologies and has transformed virtually every position he has in order to comport with the Trump administration. But the policy and the stance he has now, as laid out in that speech we were referring to, is entirely consistent with the Trump administration, which I've been saying since 2016 is ethno-nationalist in its origin. The idea is that this country isn't for everybody who's born here or is an American citizen. It's for a select group, and that certain other people don't belong, regardless of their nativity. That that in our history has shifted around who that select group is. But the point is that there's always other people who aren't real Americans on the out and to whom equal rights should not pertain. That's a long tradition going back to the 1830s. That argument, that ethno-national argument, goes back to the same time that people were first taking the Declaration's ideas and saying, hey, that's what our country should be about. There was a group of Southern intellectuals who said, no way, the Declaration is wrong. Humans aren't created equal. Only the superior Anglo-Saxon race can practice these things. And that we're a classical republic like ancient Greece and Rome, where a little minority of people at the top of the pyramid have the privilege or liberty to practice democracy and subjugation and slavery of the natural lot of the many. You know, that was how democracies worked for 2,000 years, so they had that on their side during the battle. But that's the fight: a civic national nationhood based on the Declaration's ideals, or an ethno-national one, which is inherently authoritarian, because the only way a minority of people with the right bloodlines, in quotes, can rule over everyone else is through undemocratic and authoritarian means. So,
all right,
we find ourselves here again.
Yeah, we'll hear from Lee in Brunswick in a moment, but first we're going to take a quick break. The number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we're discussing how America became so divided and what can be done to heal the rifts. My guest is Colin Woodard, director of the Nationhood Lab. He's a best-selling historian, award-winning journalist, and his latest book is called Nations Apart. Share your comments, questions, email talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, the number 1-800-399-3566. As I promised, we'll go to Lee in a moment, but Greg writes, can the same sort of divisions occur in states such as Maine? I'm also wondering, I have a follow-up question about the states that have a number of these different national these threads within them. Maine's very homogenous, by the way. It seems to be all Yankeedom. But Greg wonders, what about the two Maines? You know, Northern Maine, Southern Maine. Northern Maine seems very Appalachian. And Yankeedom more so in the South. But how do you, when people ask you about what's happening in Maine, how do you describe it in view of your filter?
At the broadest level, we're all part of that greater New England culture. I mean, we weren't to begin with, but, you know, after the English Civil War, Massachusetts conquered us by force. It may still be part of our culture to be upset about that, but there it is, and we were pulled into that institutional environment and those assumptions. Like, the idea that towns are, you know, independent little republics of their own, and woe be unto you to try to tread on the power of my town of 700 or 800. That's completely alien to the other regions of the country. You know, a county would have always governed things and bequeathed the possibility that somebody could incorporate a town within the county, but, you know, not in the towns run the show. That's a very Yankee and New England idea that goes back to the Puritans, as do many of the things that actually hold both sides of the two Maines together. But that separate economic experience of a have and have not region of the state is absolutely true. You know, I often say when talking about Maine, you know, or talking about Lobster Coast, my book on the culture of Maine, is that, you know, Boston, throughout our history, like it or not, was kind of the life-giving sun, you know, through which all economic activity and everything else folded. And the further you got from that, the harder it is to make a go of it, you know, to the point when you're out at Lubeck and Eastport and the Rim counties and, you know, up in North Franklin County where I grew up, you know, there's just not the level of like economic electrons moving around to make it very easy to make a go of it. So that seemed to be sort of the curse, and many things fall from that, particularly if you neglect the differences between regions on that level. It's less ethnographic, like some of the biggest Scots-Irish concentrations, which do have an effect on politics, are along the coast in places like Booth Bay, and then a dead giveaway, you know, freedom, liberty, unity, all those towns up there are all Scots-Irish founded. Exactly. Jefferson, even, because it was the Jeffersonians against the Federalists. So, yeah, the ethnographics don't always match, although you go to the Acadian Upper St. John Valley and to Allagash, you can see that reflected sometimes in municipal politics, too.
Okay, let's go to Lee, as promised, in Brunswick. Hi, Lee. Welcome.
Hi there. First, I want to thank Colin for his American Nations book. It was super influential on me in many fronts, and so I really appreciate that. I find that culture is – so foundational to every aspect of our lives. And, you know, I have lived in many different places, New Mexico, Montana, Portland. When you're in those places, you can feel these American nations, like they still exist. The culture is different in those places. And so I'm curious, I haven't read the new book yet, but I'd love for Colin to explain, like, what is the value of staying a single nation? You know, when our culture, these different cultures are have different ideas and ideals that we try to all come to common ground on, and that not only creates conflict, but I think it dilutes some cultural ideals. And so how is it, why wouldn't you make the case for the North America being something more like Europe, where there's, you know, a connection? We all work together as good neighbors, but we sort of accept those cultural differences and divide into separate countries.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an excellent question. I mean, you know, I think about that a lot. If you could snap your fingers and we could become more like a European Union with a shared, you know, foreign policy and trade arrangements and freedom of goods and movement and loosen the bonds between the regions, yeah, that might work out okay. But I guess my problem is that my view of the human condition in American history is sufficiently bleak to not believe that we would manage to do that without things going really badly and becoming, you know, violent and difficult. Alexander Hamilton, when arguing about whether or not we should try to create a new constitution in the Federalist Papers, said one of the most important reasons was if they didn't create a stronger constitution holding the country together, that the states would go to war with one another and that the war would be more brutal than that seen between European states. And I mean, indeed, they did go to war together. But the concern has been there this whole time that if we're not bonded together, that we could fight each other. But further, imagine a world with, if the United States did break up into separate countries, imagine what the broader world will look like. If there's no longer a United States as a superpower out there, you know, we do good and bad things in the world, but when the United States isn't involved, things tend to go worse than when we are. And you'd be facing, you know, autocratic superpowers out there in the world and a great power competition in North America between regions. That's also kind of a scary result. So I think that should all be last resort. The best thing for us to try to do is to find a way to hold ourselves together around the American experiment outlined in the Declaration, because that's, you know, brought us to a pretty amazing places and influenced the world in often a positive way, with those ideas spreading across much of Europe and Korea and Japan and many other countries where that was not the tradition, you know, even into the 20th century, and now it is. That's a very powerful and good force in for Homo sapiens, and I think it would be probably bad for the world at large if that went away.
Let's go to Mark, who's calling not from Vienna, but from Vienna. Hi, Mark. Welcome.
Thank you. In the context of the show's focus on regional divides and left versus right, red versus blue, I'm wondering about another dimension, which would be how to improve communication between top and bottom economically, the 1% versus the 90%, how that plays out around the country, or how we might better communicate across that divide.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, that effect of the reason that we're falling apart now, one of the proximate causes is a sort of breakdown in the social contract that was caused by the differences these regional cultures have in that question we talked about earlier. It is the best way to, you know, govern the country through emphasizing individual freedom or the common good, the freedom of the community. And our emphasis since 1980 onward has been increasingly in the individualistic way, you know, both in tax policy and regulation and all kinds of other things, what we invest in and don't. And that has gotten completely unbalanced. Those two forces, the common good and individual liberty, need to be in equilibrium for you to be running a maximally free and sustainable society. We're not in equilibrium. We haven't for a long time. And the result when you go in either direction, you're going to end up in tyranny. The result when you go further and further down the individualism spectrum is you start building an oligarchy where you're breaking down the ability of people starting from meager means to have any shot at getting to the top, and you're rigging the system for an emerging aristocracy, which is all counter to the American experiment. So that's how we got there. How do you communicate now? I mean, you try to get everybody aware of the problem, and that the best thing for everybody would be to shift things a little bit further from that extreme so that we don't have these massive gulfs in not only income levels, but in, you know, what the rule of law does and doesn't mean for somebody.
Seems like that ideological, the notion of equilibrium between the individual and the society is really a hard thing to sustain. Yeah. And almost the swing is inevitable. Let's go to Jamie in Portland. Hi, Jamie. Welcome. We only have a few minutes left.
Yeah, this is a quick one. Just how about a thought experiment on how things get stuck nowadays? So you've got the nations, you've had this work through, but now when we post things or put information out there, it's out there forever. So so in terms of maybe to call it stuckness or something, that you can't take anything back anymore. And I just wonder culturally how that's going to affect these regions. Is it going to make it worse or better? And so I'll leave it there.
I think social media has a lot of corrosive effects on societies everywhere. The biggest one is that often the public square is not associated with a place and therefore not with the cultural transmission in that place. And that's going to be true for everywhere. And that creates all kinds of difficulties in finding common ground in a community. So those are among the big corrosive forces out there.
You did say earlier, you talked about the test that you did, the surveys of people who, though, that believe in the founding principles of the nation, and that those were very remarkable in terms of all the other information that we know about the disparate feelings about all kinds of things.
Absolutely. And that, 97-2, people just asked, do you think that we're duty-bound as Americans to protect one another's, natural rights as put forth in the Declaration? That is, I can't emphasize how unusual that kind of lopsided finding is. I mean, our pollsters had never seen a 97-2 on any question they'd asked about anything. If you ask Americans, is the earth round or flat? And the Pew Research Center did, it's 80-10. With 10% undecided. I mean, 97-2 is as close to universal as you could ever get. Now, do people really follow through on that? No. I mean, we stress tested in the same poll some of that stuff. But the fact that sort of burnt into our subconscious as Americans, that is our purpose and that we're responsible for one another, that's something we can definitely work with. And, not something that you would see a 97-2 result if you polled people in other countries on those same kind of values. So, start there. There's common ground, and that's common ground includes people who are, Democrats and Republicans, liberals, conservatives, socialists, Greens. It's a huge coalition of people, roughly 70% of our population, who wants that to be the country we end up in. If we have that conversation, how do we get there? That's a much more constructive frame for us to debate our politics than the frameless version we have now, through which the ethno-nationalists and authoritarians can exploit their unpopular agenda.
In a way, it's sort of writing our own story as a nation, isn't it? We depend on these myths about the places and cultures from which we come. It's sort of important that we as a United States have an origin story and an ongoing story other than the place that falls apart every 4 years.
Right. Absolutely. Every nation needs that. I mean, every identity needs a story to go with it. But a national identity, you need a story. And if you're a federation of many different cultures, you need it even more. And that's what allows you to move forward and have kind of coherent public action to begin with and to feel a association, a responsibility for a stranger 3,000 miles away you'll never meet.
So how do we, I know everybody wants to know the answer to this question and you may not have it, but how do we move toward writing that story?
Yeah.
That unifying story.
I mean, we figured out the sort of one-page communications frame as to what that story contains, and it's getting people to start using it who realize you need the counter story to the far right version that most people don't actually want, and that it has to be a story that is open, you know, where people who are conservatives or Republicans don't feel like they're joining a have to join a Democratic and liberal camp. No, this is the American experiment versus dictatorship kind of equation. And we need to start being able to talk about what we, those who don't want to live in an authoritarian country, which is most of us, what are we for together, regardless of our other differences? And the answer is the Declaration. And so figuring out, I work in Nationhood Lab to talk about these things, to put them forward, both at a sort of wholesale and retail level to people to start, you know, refinding the ways we talk as Americans about what our real ideals and our real purpose is.
Yeah. Colin Woodard, thank you so much. Interesting hour.
Thanks for having me.
Colin Woodard is a journalist and author with the Nationhood Lab. His new book is Nations Apart: How Clashing Regional Cultures Shattered America. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.